Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to talk with you a little bit today about smart speakers. They are becoming increasingly popular, a great tech option for a lot of folks. They offer the convenience of voice commands, but some worry it comes at the expense of security and privacy, perhaps. We'll talk about that and a whole lot more with Jesse LeGru, technical team lead with the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. He focuses on desktop and laptop security projects, and he's here with lots of great smart speaker information. So instead of asking Alexa for an answer to your question, like I sometimes do, you can ask Jesse right now. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Jesse, thanks for coming back and being with us.
It's good to be here.
Well, let's, you know, first, there are people who probably aren't familiar with the technology, so maybe explain what a smart speaker is.
Yeah, so in this case, a smart speaker is really bridging, well, most people just play things with speakers. It's kind of the standard thing you do. You plug something in, you want it to hear a louder, more rich sound, so you spend a lot of money on speakers. In this case, it's less so about hearing that rich sound and more about getting really whatever content you want on these devices and bridging a more, you know, standard interaction between, you know, hitting buttons and actually using voice control and also bridging that speaker to the internet or to other devices in your home. So these smart speakers not only, you know, allow you to listen to content, they allow you to interact with the speaker and deliver various types of content and also interact with different devices in your house. So it could be, you know, you could have a smart home, which means a lot of different devices are kind of controlling the day-to-day of your house, including heating and cooling, your garage door, it could be your lights. And this device can actually bridge a lot of those other devices, depending on the model you go with. So it has a lot of capabilities, and it just doesn't do, you know, giving you audio content.
Well, let's see, it's probably two Christmases ago, I've got an Alexa device from my daughter. And so, you know, I come in the house and I'll say, Alexa, turn on WPR, and voila, the radio turns on. Or sometimes in the morning I'll say, what's the weather, Alexa? Or Alexa, what's the weather? I guess I put it that way, and I get the weather forecast. And so, but mine is not, Alexa, I don't have Alexa as advanced as what I'm seeing on television these days with, you know, turn on the TV and all this and that.
Yeah, you can do a lot with these devices, and depending on what model you want to go with, I mean, it opens up an avenue of just completely different things that I wouldn't even expect. And I was looking at, you know, different manufacturers had different options. They tie in with different services, but some of these different speaker manufacturers have speakers for really anything you'd like to do.
Yeah.
So you have a speaker that, hey, this is this tower I can put and I can control things. Great. It's like, well, you want one that's cheaper and you can put by your bedside. Okay, we'll make one. We can have one that has a screen that you can interact with and actually generate, you can see TV content, or you can have face-to-face video conferencing. There's just so many different things that are coming up in these smart speakers that are really, they're still considered smart speakers, but they're much, much more than what we would have think. Oh, a smart speaker, I want to play music. I want to play something else. They're doing so much more than what people would normally think from a smart speaker. It's just, it's completely amazing, really, what you can do and how it can kind of change your daily interactions.
How the heck do they work?
Well, a lot of them work by using first a keyword or a hot word that kind of wakes them up so you can interact with them and give them commands. So, you know, hello Alexa or whatever service you're going to use, they have, and you can program the words. So it wakes up, and then at that point it listens to you and it's waiting for a command. And it could be playing a specific type of music. It could be turning on the radio to a specific channel, or it could be calling somebody. You can have it bridge with different services. So it's a combination of waking it up and then giving it a command. And depending on the device, you have a wide array of commands, including, you know, people are busy from a day to day. They may have several of these smart speakers throughout their house. Say, hey, you know, I don't want to forget to go to the grocery store after work. Hey, Alexa, please put on my calendar, go to the grocery store at 6. I want a reminder at 5:30. It can do that. And so there's a lot of different things you can do, and that's just one example, but you can... It changes a lot of the normal things that I think about doing. I can have this device do it for me, although there's a dependence there, and if it makes a mistake, then you're always kind of curious about, do I have to double check it every time? And that would be my personal reflex right away. I was like, well, I told it to do this. Did it do it correctly? And so I'd have to train myself to trust this little device. And then after time, you know, I'm sure things happen. But I always want to verify that data because I can trust myself writing it down. I may not look at the piece of paper, but for a computer to do it for me, there's a lot of pieces working on that. And, you know, they work on these artificial intelligence algorithms behind the scenes to do this and do it really, really well. But you still have to see it to believe it.
Yeah, you still. And occasionally, Alexa, if somebody says Alexa on television, if I have the TV on, Alexa, my own Alexa wakes up. Yep. Wants to know what I want.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting things that you can do with that, and that's, you know, the possibility of a lot of other things outside of yourself will wake it up. And part of that also kind of stems with or brings up the security concerns,
yeah,
of when it's listening. And I was, you know, reading a lot of articles because you might see just people around with laptops and they'll have tape over their cameras because they're concerned with, if my computer's plugged into the internet and something happens to my laptop, is my laptop listening? Is somebody hacking into it and, you know, getting this different content, my own speech? Mm-hmm. And you have this speaker that's really meant to listen to you, so it wakes up at a certain time. It does something when you tell it to. There is that concern of, well, it's kind of always on. It's kind of always listening because it has to be able to hear that wake-up command. Is there some way that people could get my data? And technically, I mean, the answer is yes.
Yeah.
Technically, there's a way. But they architect the security of the device in a certain way to minimize the possibility of that happening, whether it's the architecture and computer chips or simply the software programming to say, only wake up when you hear Alexa. But if you can have something else trigger it, you know, there are ways to try to engineer ways to go around that and to hack into a system.
Sort of verbally password it.
Right.
Nick in Wanakee has something for us. Let's go there. Nick, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Sure thing. What's on your mind?
My question is, I recently saw a term and condition for an app on my phone that said they not only have access to my browsing history, but also my stored passwords and things like that. And they have the right to sell this information to other companies for advertising purposes. So I was wondering, when using Alexa, how many different terms and conditions am I signing up for?
And that's a really great question. And without digging into the end user agreement for any of these specific services, it's always an important thing to review. And even looking at some of these different manufacturers, How do you give consent, for example? And a lot of them are, by turning it on, you're basically granting consent to this, this, and this. It's not very explicit. You're not told, by the way, check all these boxes. We want to make you fully aware of what you're doing before you decide to use this device. So I can't actually answer that very well because I'd actually have to scratch through the EULA. But you're agreeing to probably a lot of things that without, you know, looking through the items, you're really not sure until you actually look. So I can't answer the question. The only thing I can say about any service is to dig through that. And you really have to do it online because those terms and conditions can change over time. And something you continually agree to may actually be modified with a software update or with something else. Very commonly, it's similar to a lot of other websites in terms of sharing data, either with specifically, let's say, Amazon or any of their different providers. And usually it's going to be the search content that they're collecting. And from there, I think you can actually, for some of these services, actually look online and it will tell you what it's collecting. And I don't know if it'll tell you exactly where it's sharing it, but at least you can see What were the commands that were given to it? Where, you know, a lot of people stated, you know, they might have Alexa stop because, you know, it's doing things you don't want it to do. And so they're actually trying to stop this little machine from doing something. And they do collect that. What they do with it is really outlined in that end user license agreement. But there are probably a lot of things that you wouldn't normally think of. And a lot of it really is geared towards advertising. Some of it is to actually improve the product, because some of the feedback and knowing how things are working or not working actually helps them improve the product. But I'm sure there are other items that are actually generated towards delivering better ad material or delivering content to you that's more personalized, because a lot of these are money-generating devices, not only to buy it once, but to give you advertising so you can think about buying other things. So those are, you know, other possibilities. But without looking at the end user license agreement, I can't say specifically.
Oh, there we go. So you need to check it out, Nick. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Love to hear from you. What about setting, you know, some of these are so complex in terms of what they can do. How complex are they to set up?
Most of the devices are, they try to keep it pretty user-friendly, which one of the recommendations when looking at any of these different kinds of smart speakers is pick one from a manufacturer that you are very, very well acquainted with. If you use a lot of Amazon services, using an Amazon device might be the best for you. If you use Google services a lot, using a Google device might work better for you. And a lot of those user interactions are easily translatable from device to device or service to service. So many of them are very easy, but just like anything, some of them are probably very easy and some of them are probably very difficult. But a lot of the Amazon and Google devices are relatively easy to set up, but it also depends on how you want to use it. If you only want, I want it to connect to the internet and have it, you know, feed me radio every now and again, it might be good. If you want it to interact, like, well, I want you to control my thermostat and control this and control this, it might be different. But there are a lot of ways to bundle those services together. So it always depends on how much you want to do with it. The more you want to do, the more difficult most likely it is to configure. But it also depends on those back-end services. I use the Nest thermostat at home, for example. Yeah. To tie that in with other services, if those companies are talking a lot with each other, it's going to be pretty easy.
Okay.
But otherwise, it might require different connections that can be kind of a headache, especially for cloud-based services where you don't have a device in your home that's controlling it. It's kind of the internet out there and the internet of things that's controlling all of these devices, because for most of these, you have a separate username and a separate password. So for my Nest, I have an authentication for one, and another one doesn't match, and another one doesn't match. How do you tie all these together? There are ways to do that, but that's why it can be more or less complicated. So if you want to have a really, really high-tech smartphone, or a smart home, I should say, and tie all this together, using the same manufacturer for all these devices helps quite a bit. But if you have half a dozen different kinds of devices and different manufacturers, it can be much more of a headache.
Well, we had a caller who said we're turning on every device in his house because we keep saying Alexa. And we probably just did it again.
Yes, that very well could happen. And I don't know, for a lot of these devices, some of them you can change the hot word. Some of them, the main hot word you can remove or not. And those are the items that's always useful of being able to customize. And sometimes those hot words you can customize fully, meaning that you can make up a word for it, or you can only select a new hot word from a list, which personally I like the fully customized version, because I can at least reduce the likelihood that's going to happen. I don't actually have one at home, so I've never tried, you know, to say, well, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, that's going to be my keyword, and there's no way anything's going to happen. But that's also, you know, one of the challenges with those devices. You're always waking them up. There's a lot of other conflicts that can happen. They're useful, although they all come with, you know, their own challenges.
Jesse LeGrew, technical team lead with the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. I'm Larry Mueller. Chris Molina, our on-air producer. Dave Poltratz, our engineer. Here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at smart speakers today on the show with our guest, Jesse LeGrew from the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, taking a close look at those, but we'll take your other computer questions as well as we move along. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's take another call. Jim in Norway, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, actually, I have one of these devices, and one of the questions that I have about it, I use a music service as well, and often when I ask for a particular song or whatever, I won't get the most popular artist that sang that song. Sometimes I'll get the karaoke version or, you know, the 70 strings version. Or, and I wondered whether the services do that because maybe Spotify or, you know, one of the other services, if they do that because they pay less royalty, you know, for that version of the song. Now, I will mention that, it does work fine if I give them the name of the song and the artist. It's just, you know, the situation where a lot of times I'll, you know, ask for just the song name. And like I say, I usually get odd versions of it.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a really good question. Actually, I even think about that just by browsing even my own music collection, because you can collect a lot of versions. And it always depends on the music provider that you do have. It's very likely that they could have a search for a specific term, and it could just be the first in the alphabet, the way they have it categorized digitally in their system. It could be because one's sponsored and one's not. It could be the royalty. I think there's a lot of factors that play in, and it will depend service to service. But giving additional qualifiers to be as explicit as possible is really the best way to make sure that you're getting what you're looking for. I have the same issue even with, I have a voice-activated stereo in my car, and if I have MP3s and it's searching through them, I might get something completely different because there's another song that matches, but I have to give it more information to make sure I'm getting the exact song that I want by the right artist. So a lot of those factors come into play, and I don't have an exact answer, but give it more data and it'll be able to make a better decision for you.
There we go. Thanks, Jim. Appreciate the call. Another Jim in Sockville this time. Hi, Jim.
Howdy.
What can we do for you?
I am curious what actually prevents any of these devices from being used as an open mic in my home by either the company that I buy it from, Google or Amazon, or by, let's say, FBI or CIA or Putin.
Yeah.
What's protecting me from it just being an open speaker in my house?
There's a variety of things that help with that. Now, granted, all of these items that are meant to secure it are developed by people, so that's just one thing to note. Anything you put in your, you know, house that's developed by a person, these people can do a lot of things with it. But there are security mechanisms on the device, not only in the software, but also in the hardware, which the hardware is actually kind of catching up right now. They're even developing chips specifically for mobile device data security, which would actually also be involved with these smart speakers, to encrypt the data to make sure no one can read specific items. Probably the most important portion of these smart speakers that help to give it that security really is that hot word. So the idea that they're listening but not really listening is really where that hot word comes in. So if I do wake up a device with whatever I name it, as soon as it hears that name, then it's actually actively listening instead of passively listening just to wake up and know it needs to do something or it needs to collect some data to perform an action. That's probably the most important security measure, is really whatever that hot word is. because whenever it wakes up, then it's going to listen. It's probably going to transmit that data to a service because it has to look up whatever command you're giving it to make sure that it understands what it is. So the wake-up command is the first piece. There's a lot of other logical pieces in the software, but also the hardware components of the chips, and they can help to encrypt the data between different locations and help to secure that. But it's also one of the reasons I'd say look at an end-user license agreement. A lot of things are put in place and looked for by a variety of organizations to make sure that companies are doing what they need to be doing. And there's been a lot of this also, you know, in the news about how is data being shared. And some of this is written down. It's just whether we read it or not. And we need to be very conscious about the services that we're utilizing and what they're doing. And that changes on a day-to-day basis, unfortunately, which can make it complicated.
Yeah. Thanks for that call. Well, let's turn to Henry in Gladstone, Michigan. Hi, Henry.
Hi, Henry. How are you guys doing?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, me and my wife just purchased an Alexa. That's actually what I'm listening to you guys on right now. And we've had the discussion that I'm sure everyone has about how maybe it's listening. Is it listening or not? And we've decided, oh, well, if it is, it's listening. It's convenient. It's great to have. It does a lot of good for us.
Yeah. You know what? I think a lot of people are with you on that one, Henry. What do you think,
I'm kind of on the same. Everything digitally is so, I wouldn't say easy to get to, but, you know, your life's somewhere. The books that you buy, the media that you consume, whether it's, you know, I use Amazon a lot. I buy things on Amazon. Well, Amazon knows a lot about me. Mm-hmm. That data, there's data everywhere about me all over the place. And it's just one of those items where, you know, part of it I accept where that's the case, but it's also not going to be very likely retrieved by other people. And even if, let's say, Amazon can take a look at the data, they probably don't care. You know, it's just one more piece of data. It's another row or another column. So for me, I kind of make that balance. And as long as, you know, there's a good amount of safety precautions in the mix, I'm usually okay with it, and I don't actually have a smart speaker at home, although I'd get one for convenience. I mean, there's a lot of little items that I think I could use, and if I really wanted to be extra cautious, I could myself put extra controls in place. I could make sure it's only active when I'm around or not. There's a lot of benefits actually that can add security by utilizing these devices.
Oh, how's that? How so?
Well, thinking about, and to be honest, I don't know if this is the case or not, but let's say somebody is breaking into your house. A smart speaker could potentially be an item that could alert based on certain sounds. Let's say it's breaking glass. Could it actually alert you that, hey, I heard a sound that sounds like breaking glass? I think these smart speakers and a lot of these other devices could be used in a variety of ways to increase your security. I think there's the personal privacy concerns that we all have, but there's always a balance there. I think anything can be used for, you know, the good of society or, you know, the reverse.
Yeah.
It just depends on how we want to use it, and it always depends on the individuals and the organizations that are in control of those technologies and those different services. So for me, you know, I pretty much trust Amazon. If I didn't, there would be a lot of things I wouldn't be, you know. I use it all the time. I get books and everything else. And that's also one of those items that people are really concerned about. I don't want people to know what I'm reading. Mm-hmm. Amazon does. I mean, they have my data.
Yeah.
But it's also one of those items of privacy because it does tell people a lot about who you are. That data is out there. I'd probably be more concerned with that than I would actually right now about a smart speaker in my house.
Hmm. Henry, thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's turn to Steve in Danbury next. Hi, Steve. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm going to give you the curmudgeon's point of view. First of all, I think all these gadgets and gizmos are out there because tech companies have figured out if we build it, you'll buy it. And then I'm thinking about that last caller and his attitude about his private data or his private conversations being listened to. I'm 65 years old, and that would appall me. But I think younger people, they're already on social media sort of disclosing a lot of personal information there. And I think what happened with Facebook and Cambridge Analytics, hardly a ripple in the use of Facebook. So I think maybe there's a generation gap there, but I guess I just don't have any use for these gadgets and gizmos. I can walk over and turn my radio on. I don't need to tell some smart device to do it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, Steve, you're probably not alone on that. What do you think, Jesse?
Yeah, I think there is there's a lot of difference with the use of technology, and in this case, convenience. There is a lot of convenience with these devices more and more that people just find really appealing, but there's also a benefit to not having the convenience, doing something, you know, the old-fashioned way or doing it a different way. And I think the growth of people, you know, growing up with technology changes how it's being used. And I think socially, technology and personal information, I think even the idea of what personal information is probably is even shifting throughout the generations, considering the fact that we do have Facebook and we have other methods for sharing information that at one point people might have felt should never be shared, that are actually being shared more regularly. So it even brings up the question, what is personal information? How has the definition of personal information changed from generation to generation? And I think right now is a very interesting time just due to that sharing being much more frequent and maybe in some ways actually less of a concern.
You know, as Steve was talking, I was thinking back to the time when we had to get up and from the couch and go over and change the channel on the television set. And I'm sure Steve has a remote, and he wouldn't have any choice probably in the matter anymore because you couldn't buy a television set that didn't have that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's things shift in so many different ways where something that looks, I guess, manual no longer looks manual. You just, a remote? Yeah, you'd always have a remote. Why wouldn't you have a remote?
Mm-hmm.
That shift is just really, really interesting. And I actually do woodworking every now and again, and I use machines, so I don't do a whole lot of handwork.
Yeah.
It's something I actually want to learn, but I use machines all the time. I take that shortcut. There's other things I can kind of expand on and learn. I was like, yeah, I don't want to deal with that other stuff. But I think that's different person to person. It's also impacted dramatically by what you grew up with.
Yeah.
I remember actually changing knobs. You had a top and a bottom where you could do, changing your channels, just completely unusual now. But now you can even voice activate. And you don't have to push a button. You can just tell something and it'll actually change the channel. But that might become more and more of the norm, where touching something is actually completely foreign.
Yeah, it's such a change. I was thinking about tape. You know, here in broadcasting, I still hear the term tape. Well, let's tape something. And here nobody is taping anything, but we talk about taping because it's that's what we did for forever.
When I even think about a computer program like Word or other applications where they have a save button, and the save button's a floppy disk. How many people understand the context of really what that is? Like, I know I click this button, but what is that thing? It's really unusual. It's just changes from time to time, and sometimes we don't even think about, well, should the save button be a different icon now? What should that be? So it's just interesting how that changes and how, you know, technology has just changed the way that we live, and that context over time kind of disappears. It becomes almost lost in history.
Yeah.
In terms of what it is. And, you know, people growing up, that save button is just one example where people, they may not know at all unless they're interested, they want to tinker, they want to see something. But outside of that, they might never really get that without researching it.
Yeah. Steve, thanks again. Appreciate the call. Let's turn to Kenneth in Janesville next. Kenneth?
Hello. Can Alexa make phone calls and receive phone calls?
That's a good question. They do have different services that you can utilize to do that. And I found a few different ways online to do it. I've never done it myself, but you can actually find some guides online of how to make phone calls. In this case, it does depend on whether you do want to pair it with another device like a cell phone, or if you actually want Alexa to actually have kind of a back-end calling plan that would actually use to communicate over the internet using something called VoIP or voice over IP address. Do you know, is this something you're trying to do right now or a specific situation you'd like to use it in?
No, I just wondered about that capability.
Yeah, I think for people with certain issues, it could be, I'm thinking about people who may be in some ways other abled or blind, or that could be perhaps, and I'm speaking with total ignorance here, but thinking about how it could be useful to people who might have difficulty doing those things.
Yeah, and there are capabilities for doing it. They do have applications you can actually install on your smartphone specifically for the Amazon products that help to bridge that connection between
gotcha.
A cell phone and Alexa. I think in this case, there's a lot of different ways to do it. For one example, I was thinking about the Echo devices or the Google devices, and you know, Google Voice, I think, is actually still around. That might actually bridge that gap. I haven't used it personally, but I would be really surprised if a lot of those features didn't come out. They can utilize a lot of different devices within your house, and the capability is there with a variety of them. I think the ease of use is going to be different depending on what it is, but there are capabilities with some of these devices to do that.
Thanks again, Kenneth. Let's go to Dousman next and talk to Vic. Hi, Vic. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Hey, I've called a curmudgeon pretty often, but not in this case. When you're a grandpa and you have a good grandson story, all of that goes, you know, to the side. So my grandson, Charlie, in North Carolina, is really bright and really quirky and 2.5 years old. And the other night before he went to sleep, just like out of the blue, he said, "Alexa, put paper towel on the shopping list." And I love that story so much. Told it so many times that we have about 10 paper towels on our shopping list.
There you go, Vic. You got to be careful what you say.
Yeah, we probably have another one. I just wanted to share that.
Thank you very much for calling. Oh, yeah, there could be some amusing things. Well, with Alexa, you can come in and say, "Tell me a joke today." Or there are fun things that you can do with probably all of them.
Yeah, I do like the fact that, especially if you do, I use Amazon a lot, so using something like that to order makes mm-hmm. things a lot easier. But also just, I want to know something really quick, and I want to go through the, I'll say hassle, but the more manual process of vetting information and reading through articles, I can ask it a question. I can let the artificial intelligence do all the work for me and spit out the answer, which most of the time is from Wikipedia. But these devices help to bridge that gap. I want the information. It can help to deliver it. And it makes that really, really easy, which is very convenient.
Yeah. John in Madison, we'll turn to you next. Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. I just had a comment today. I studied statistics and computer science at the UW-Madison. And I'm wondering what people are so afraid of when Alexa and devices like that are collecting data. Like when you order a pizza, who cares if they hear what you're ordering or what you're discussing? But if you're discussing your social security number or something, just turn the thing off.
Yeah.
I know that's a simplification, but
yeah,
I'm not afraid of it at all.
Mm-hmm. Jesse?
Yeah, and I think that, for everyone, whatever they kind of feel is a personal risk is kind of a self-definition, too. Some people want to share certain things where other people don't. Some people might consider their pizza order very, very private. Like, I don't want anyone to know I like anchovies. Although in my case, you know, I'm not too concerned. That definition changes from person to person. There are mitigating controls you can put in place. You can turn things off. You can go to a different room. Everyone has their own personal concerns. And I think, you know, knowing the device and your own personal concerns, you're going to customize your use of a tool based on those preferences. And there's always something you can do. You can always turn something off. You can make sure that things can't listen in certain ways. If I was really concerned actually about this and I was using wireless, you know, I could build like a tiny little Faraday cage, just put it right over the speaker when I wanted to. It'll kill the internet access, everything else. And then when I'm ready, I just pull the thing off. Wow. Might not even have to turn the device off. I can make it a very easy thing for me to put it into a, you know, you can't listen to anything mode, and then open it back up so I can utilize it. There are ways to do it, some more complicated than others. But, you know, if you do have that concern with not fully trusting a device, that concern is going to be there. And it's hard to alleviate it without understanding everything about the technology. But, you know, it's a personal preference in that point, too.
John, thanks. Let's go to Dan in Wind Lake next. Hi, Dan.
Hey, good morning, fellas. Hey, great program. I have an Echo, of course, or Alexa, and it's wonderful. It will call any number that is in my cell phone. My wife is disabled. If she were to fall, she can just holler out, "Alexa," I have to be careful because it's on.
Yeah.
"Call 911 or call me or call anyone else." So it saves a lot of money not having one of those machine things you have to hang on to your pay monthly for, let's say, for that type of service.
Yeah. Thanks very much for that. So nice to know that that it does work that way. Dan, thank you again for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, we've been talking about smart speakers a lot, but we can take other computer questions as well. So if you have something that's bugging you, or maybe it's bugging your computer or your software, you can join in with those kinds of questions too. Number 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at smart speakers and other computer issues today with our guest, Jesse LeGrew, technical team lead within the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. So you have a software issue, a software problem, maybe a comment or question about smart speakers. I hope you'll join in. Again, 800-642-1234. Let's go back to the phones. Jonah in Madison up next. Jonah, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. Thank you.
Yep.
A couple comments. One thing I wanted to bring up was that the convenient nature of these things. I think that whenever we gain a convenience, that we have to pay for it somehow. And the way that we pay for it with these devices is with allowing access to information, because utility is based on the depth of information that they have about us. And I think that it's clear that people are willing to sacrifice deep things, deep important things, for a very simple convenience in a moment when that's the only thing on their mind. And I think the result is that in the long term, people don't think it's really important, but this aggregation about each of our persons is going to grow and grow and grow and grow. And whose hands is it in? As we've seen, like, data is not secure. Cambridge Analytica, the credit bureau that got hacked, all this stuff is incredibly vulnerable, not only to obviously rogue actors, but even to, whatever the state ends up becoming.
Yeah.
And, the people who think that this is, just something that you can use to order paper towels with, and that it's funny that if you say that on the radio, you get more paper towels, they're completely missing the entire thrust of this whole movement and what it's going to become. And I believe that that's intentional, because what a better way to get something to happen than to make it an attractive, sexy, convenient thing that you can use to become more lazy.
Yeah. Well, let's, Jesse, comment on that?
And I think that the, you know, any kind of convenience does pay for it in some way where there's a balance. I think that's definitely the case where there is a cost somewhere. And that data privacy, the way things are going with technology is definitely a concern. In regards to, you know, what data, how it's used or who can access it, I think that's one of those things that's going to be more and more of a concern as we go forward. I think I was even thinking about this kind of during the break about historical data and kind of what we might have been concerned of at one point. And at one point, it might have been file folders and file cabinets sitting in a room that was locked by all of this stuff. And right now, it's much more digital. I think paper records are still a concern. But when we do all have access to the internet and things are connected in this worldwide web, that visibility and that potential to access data much more easily and to put things more out in the open increases. And that is, in some ways, a convenience cost. And, you know, everyone kind of makes their own decisions, but I think we also make decisions based on what we know at the moment. And what we know at the moment is, in many ways, just the surface. If we really wanted to dig down and fully understand it, we might change what we're doing and how we're acting. But for many people, that's just not something that they're willing to take that risk than to delve into much more deeper to kind of understand the challenges behind it. But for most people, it's also not a concern. You know, they're using these devices, they've never had an issue, and, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, what is it going to look like? It's going to be a really good question, because I think privacy and data security, I mean, they're a concern now. With all these devices and the potentials there, I think it's going to be interesting to see how things do look in a couple decades.
Yeah, interesting. I flashed back to my old, my other building where I teach my classes and so forth, and it's an old building. I think I built it around 1906. Originally, every floor has a large safe in it, and it's was there. That's where you stored the records of your students, because if the building burned down, the records supposedly would survive the fires. So that was some original security kinds of issues that we had on the UW-Madison campus.
Yeah, and it was an interesting thing. I was actually listening to a podcast this weekend that was talking about kind of being off the grid in a way. And, you know, this individual actually didn't have, a birth certificate or anything else, and they had to go through this whole process. So they kind of went the other way. But that in itself had its own challenges when reconnecting with a society that's based on, you know, this governmental structure and all this other paperwork, really.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to get reinserted without certain items. And once again, there's that balance. You can be on either extreme or somewhere in the middle. Most people are somewhere in the middle, but it is a challenge to kind of make that decision with your data and how it's going to act. And we all have ideas of how it might be. We probably really won't know until we get there, but it's gonna be interesting.
Let's go to Sharon in Wadsworth, Illinois. Hi, Sharon.
Hello.
What's on your mind today?
Yeah, I was just wondering if devices like Alexa could be used as a point of access from some outside source to other devices within your house. For instance, your computer, where you might have a whole bunch of sensitive stuff.
Yeah,
and largely I would say no. Most of the time, Alexa or any of these other smart devices, they'll coordinate with only devices that you've paired them with. So, excuse me, without basically granting access to these devices through the smart speaker, the smart speaker is not going to be able to access them, and you can only access Alexa or any of these other speakers in specific situations, most of the time when you're physically next to it. So if I had a smart speaker in my house, for example, and I didn't do anything, you know, to bridge it to my computer, because it really doesn't do that. It's more concerned with internet-facing services. It's not going to allow somebody access to my computer. If you want to go really down the rabbit hole, technically anything on a network, you might be able to try to use to access other devices. But out of the box, it's only going to be able to interact with devices you've granted access to. And to interact with Alexa generally, you're going to need to be in the room to bridge that control gap.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Sharon. Jordan in Plover, Wisconsin, your turn.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask a question, probably give an opportunity for a shameless plug, but could you talk to us about how to actually connect to WPR through our smart devices, Amazon or Google or more popular ones?
You know, I'm trying to remember how I did that when I got Alexa, and I can't remember what I did. I've got it. There are a couple of different stations, and I don't think it was much of a trick to do it.
Yeah, and apparently, I actually decided to look up the directions. They're actually on WPR.org.
Okay.
They actually have an article on how to connect a smart speaker.
That's probably how I did it the first time.
And all it states is you just need to tell it a command, which is, you know, in this case, they state, Alexa, play Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yeah.
And it will start playing the Ideas Network live stream. So it does look like a lot of it's fairly automated out of the box, as long as it's, you know, connected publicly to the internet. It also depends on probably the radio station itself and its visibility to the internet or other sources of media. And in this case, it looks like you can simply state the command, and as long as it has internet access, should be able to pull it up.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I think I might have just been experimenting and asked.
Yep, and since WPR has a live stream, it just picks it up automatically.
Yeah, that's probably how I did. So it's pretty easy, Jordan. Thank you so much for calling. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comment. Yeah, we just got a note from somebody saying, yeah, just that's exactly how you do it. Just say, play Wisconsin Public Radio and give the name of your device. And
yep, and that'll depend service by service. So some radio stations, it may not work. Others, it will. But in this case, since there's a live internet stream, it'll be able to pick it up.
Let's take a, by the way, join in again, 800-642-1234. As we will switch gears a little bit here and talk about computer issues, software, and things of that nature. At the Division of Information Technology, you probably see just about everything. What are some of the common things that you're seeing in terms of problems these days?
They're always the same, similar problems. I think one of the most challenging things, which it feels like it's been a little bit easier recently, but I think one of the most common things that people do see are, you know, password challenges. There are a lot of challenges right now, especially with phishing, which is people sending email or trying to get your personal information by really social engineering, allowing people to click on things because, you know, they make you think it's the help desk and you have to give your credentials. Passwords and credentials is probably, this is a security topic, but it's something that everyone deals with all the time, is typing in a username and password or using a different authentication service. And I think it's one of the most challenging right now, because we see that problem. The phishing attempts, they're drafting those emails really, really well. And unless you know a little bit about what to look for and have a little bit of that technology information, it's difficult to discern, is this a valid email from my university, my employer, my brother, my sister, or is this somebody else trying to get my information? And that's probably one of the biggest challenges, because it requires knowledge and education as well.
So how do you, what are the best ways to check on that as you're, you know, is this really from my brother or whatever?
The one is, if it is from somebody you do know, read through the email, notice whether there's, you know, are there grammatical mistakes that are normal or not normal. It's like, well, they always misspell everything. Everything looks really, really grammatically correct. Look for those things that don't seem normal. A lot of times, the grammar's a big one.
Yeah.
Having anything in all caps is a big one. Having links when you hover over them that don't match what you think it's going to is a big one.
Hovering is a good idea.
Hovering is a good idea. I always turn off, you know, by default, a lot of email programs will do this too, is turning off loading images and a lot of other external content. One item that I've done, you know, you can look at links, you can look at email addresses, look for anything that just looks unusual. But if I have an email from a company in the past and I compare that with a new email I just received, usually they have pretty standard formatting. They might have very standard signatures. I might compare if I'm really concerned, does this look the same or does this look different? And, you know, this is the challenge because a lot of these emails are well crafted, so it's easy to get around that.
And I've got a question coming up for you. As I had, I was visiting at some friend's place yesterday, and the youngster found his iTunes machine device that he had lost 4 or 5 years earlier, and was trying to figure out how to get the password back, and he couldn't remember it. So that's something we can talk about. I don't think he's still figured that out yet. Our guest today, Jesse LeGrew, technical team lead within the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Computer concerns or questions, I hope you'll join in. We'll be back with Jesse right after the news. Stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your computer today, and we've been talking about smart speakers as well with our guest, Jesse LeGrew, technical team lead within the UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, focuses on desktop and laptop security projects, but certainly happy to answer your computer question. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Just before our news break, Jesse, we were talking about a neighbor, grandson, actually, of friends, Noah, who lost his iTunes device 4 or 5 years ago, suddenly found it buried in a, you know, in the crease of an old chair, and was trying to get on. They charged it and it would turn on, but he couldn't get in because he didn't remember the password.
Yeah, and that's going to be a tricky one for a couple of reasons. So normally you can reset an iPhone or an iPod or any Apple device using iTunes. The downside is to get in, you have to wipe the data. So you're going to have to actually reset, and then, you know, ideally they say back up your data. You're going to have to restore it from a backup. One of the interesting challenges in this case, so if it's, let's say it's 4 years old, a lot of the devices out there, they need to be at a certain software level. So you can even use iTunes with them. You might actually need an older computer with an older version of iTunes to even reset it. It does depend on the device, so it might work, and they do have a reset you can do, but at the very least, you'll need to wipe all the data and set it up from scratch. There's no other way to break into it.
Okay. Noah, I hope you were listening and you heard that. Let's take some calls. Again, the number is 800-642-1234. John in Fond du Lac, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Certainly. I have a question about passwords. Everybody wants passwords and they don't want it to be the same. What's a safe way to store them? To store all the various passwords that a person might have.
And part of this I'll go through a few different options because it also depends on how you want to use your passwords and where you want to use them. If you wanted the most secure, you know, people say, how do you make a computer secure? Just disconnect it from the network, you know, because the network, the internet's kind of dangerous. You can actually store them offline in a paper format that's actually locked. So you could actually secure passwords just like you would any other kind of device which is one method, like a safe deposit box, for example. You can go all that entire extreme. But if you actually want to use these passwords on a daily basis, it's probably not practical. So there's a lot of different password managers that you can use that might work for an iPhone, that might work for an Android, or that might work on a normal web browser for Mac OS, Windows, or Linux. And a password manager I've used in the past, LastPass, works really, really well. They also have options for what they call two-factor or multi-factor authentication. Any password manager that allows you to also set a different method of authentication is going to help to protect those passwords. Because when you think about, you know, let's say you have 100 passwords to store. Well, you're protecting it with one password, which is kind of scary in itself, because if somebody gets that one password, you're out of luck, which is where that second factor comes in. It could be a different smartphone application. So Google Authenticator is a very common one. It could be a third-party service that actually offers a one-time password or a token to unlock it in addition with your password. Many of those, you know, you'll go to a website, I want to get my password to use, I'll type in my password, then my phone that's paired with it, I get a pop-up on my phone so I can hit agree and then it unlocks it. So it means I need to know the password and I need to have my phone. So yeah. It gives you different methods to secure it, but the security is going to really be balanced by how you want to use it. So there's always a balance between usability and security. And in this case, if you really want to be super paranoid, I would actually write it on paper. I would actually encrypt it old school on paper, store the encrypted password in a safe deposit box, and keep the key somewhere else. It gets really convoluted, but this is what people did a long time ago before we actually had to do with computers. But most likely, look for a password manager. There's great ones online. And look for ones that are going to work with your situation, because most are going to work on multiple platforms, and some are free, some are not. But there's a lot of great solutions, whether you want to do it internet-based or store it only locally on your computer. So great options out there. But password manager is probably where you're going to want to go, and there's a lot of great tools out there for it.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions or comments, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Or one more, go to our Ideas Network Facebook page and ask your question there. Let's go back to issues that you're seeing, Jesse, that come up from time to time with the people that you have to work with every day.
Yeah, and the password's a big one, but a lot of it, I think the one I've probably heard the most often and even on the show has been software updates. Software updates that break something that doesn't work without a software update, especially with one, people like to get new features all the time. They like something to have expanded capabilities. Many times to do that, you need an update. To get updates, you also need internet access. And while, you know, many of us on a day-to-day basis actually take that for granted in some cases, some people are actually living out in locations where they don't have readily available internet access. So they have to find other ways to update their devices. They might physically need to go somewhere else to get updates. So keeping things up to date is always a concern, but actually having internet access and the capability to do that regularly can also be a challenge. But I think people just like the end user license agreements, whenever somebody hears update, I don't think it really makes anyone like really excited, like, oh, I get an update today. This is going to be the best day ever. I'm going to be able to have this new cool stuff. Some people have that because they're used to devices that whenever they get an update, they get a new button. They get something else that they get to play with and learn about, and it's going to make their life much more convenient. But sometimes they're just updates because, well, we need to update it. Otherwise, these security flaws that were out there, they're going to make your device more vulnerable. They're going to make your data more likely to be compromised in some way. So updates can be a challenge, but it's in order for them to work, people have to restart devices or computers. Many people don't want to do that. You get a pop-up, hey, to apply these updates, please restart your computer. So, well, I'm busy right now. I'm going to do some other things. I'm going to come back to that. That's just a constant challenge to keep your computer up to date, to balance that with your use on every day. Because for many people, hitting that restart button, they're losing the work they have on their screen. They have to save certain items. So from that daily perspective, that can be a very, very challenging situation.
We had a caller who couldn't stay on, who had a MacBook question. Her daughter's laptop died, and she can't get a new charger until tomorrow. She needs homework on it today. Are there any options, either in terms of getting a new charger quick or getting data off a dead computer somehow?
In this case, if you're close to an Apple store, go right to an Apple store. I'm sure they'll plug in the device, they'll make sure it can get charged, and they'll probably help you, if you have a flash drive, get the data off. They're very, very helpful. If you don't have an Apple store, go to any other computer store. Computer stores are going to have chargers available that either you can buy or they'll simply plug one in, because many of the computer stores out there also repair computers. In order to repair computers, they have a stock of power adapters, most likely, and they'd be more than happy to probably plug it in and let you charge it. Anywhere that has any kind of computer service will most likely be able to help you. They're going to have a charger, and you can go that way. There are also some locations that will also rent out computers, which come with adapters, which might be for a fee-based service, or it could be free depending on your situation. On campus, for example, students can rent computers from some of our labs, and they might be no cost. So there could be those options too, but I would say go to an Apple store or go to another computer repair place. They're going to have them. They're going to be able to plug it in and charge it, and then help you get that data off.
I was thinking about my phone. I had the last time I got a new phone, I also got a charger that's actually fits on the phone itself. And so if I'm away from power and the charge gets down to like 7% or something like that, I just push a button and it charges the phone, and it charges the phone pretty quickly. And that has saved me more than once, I can tell you that for free. And I really like that kind of feature. And it's I don't remember what I paid for it. It was probably somewhere in the $80 range or something like that to have that charger. And then it automatically charges when you're charging the phone back up. When you plug it in, it charges both at the same time.
Yeah, having those battery backups and other sources are really nice to have around.
They're not that you don't have that sort of thing, do you? With let's say a MacBook or something like that.
You can. I think I've seen them around. I haven't used them. I remember actually carrying, just like cell phones, carrying extra batteries with me. I had to actually buy extra batteries and keep them with me. Now, with Apple devices, the way they are structured right now, you can't just plug in a new battery, but you can get docks that might have a battery built in that actually plug in, that can give you alternative power sources. But it's another thing, and they do cost money. But there are a lot of options out there for extended battery packs, usually external, for a variety of manufacturers.
Bob called in regarding the charger dilemma and suggested calling a hotel or motel in the area. They often have boxes of chargers that have been left behind.
Yep, another good idea.
I like that idea. Thanks, Bob. What about you? Question or comment? I'm surprised we don't have calls waiting here. We do when Jesse LeGru's on. You can join in. We'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Love to hear from you. What's on the let's talk a little bit about what's on the horizon before other phones. What's on the horizon, new things that you're seeing in the software area or the computer area that you may or may not be excited about?
The one that I've been actually excited about for a while but haven't been able to experience myself is actually virtual reality, which is one thing the I'm trying to think of the company that actually was creating the VR headsets. There's many of them out there. Sony was doing it. But actually utilizing that technology for a variety of things is pretty interesting. One, for consuming media like movies, but also games, also research. There's a lot of interesting applications to virtual reality that can really open up a lot of different avenues for just different experiences, but also for learning, and in some ways, actually even therapy, which is interesting as well.
I have not, I haven't tried that yet, and I've been thinking that I've got to try it, and you'll see an ad on TV once in a while where somebody just goes, oh my goodness, when they put it on, they just about go crazy, and I want to experience that, and I haven't done it yet.
Yeah, there's great like entertainment applications, but also, I mean, thinking about training to do something.
Yeah.
A virtual reality where you can get experiential training in a virtual situation.
Sure.
There's so many different applications, which is really neat.
Let's go to Donald in Madison next. Donald, hi. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. I just replaced my, I'm trying to replace my iPad, the original issue iPad, and now a few years later, I couldn't get the apps that I wanted, so I ordered an iPad with 11 on it, and it's iPad 4. And I want to transfer everything. What I did do is I think I got everything off of the iCloud to the new one, but all the rest of the stuff, I don't know how to transfer it, if that's even possible.
And it depends on the data that you have on there. Most of the time for iPad content, sometimes it's synchronized from the internet, sometimes it's synchronized from the computer that you plugged it into. And to put it from one device to another, you need to have that original content located on your computer. So if there was music, for example, and you had it on an old computer that you synchronized with your old iPad, in order to put it on the new iPad, you need to have that same computer content to synchronize with the new iPad. There are some other options there too. Because you mentioned, for example, iCloud, you may be able to do the same thing with that data by telling your old iPad to synchronize with a cloud service and then pull it down from that cloud service. But that's actually something I'd even potentially go to the Apple Store for, too. Once again, they're generally very, very helpful. And they also might have tools at their disposal that we might not as normal consumers to help transfer that content. But they'll also have a lot of different ideas on how to do it. It's amazing how many workarounds you can find for a variety of issues.
Thanks, Don. Appreciate the call. Dave in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Dave. Oh, did we lose Dave? Maybe we lost Dave. Let's go to Betsy in Madison. Betsy, hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I access the internet via my phone using my hotspot, and that has worked just fine until I recently got a new lower-end Dell laptop. And when I open up the laptop to access the internet, it says that it's identifying my hotspot, but it's not providing any access. And so I have to restart my laptop every time I want to access the internet. Why is it doing that, and how can I fix it?
Have you had that issue with any other type of internet on that laptop, whether it's wireless somewhere else?
Oh, now that's a good question. I'm not sure I've taken it anywhere else.
That would be one thing I'd try. I've had similar challenges with computers in the past. Sometimes, because it could be, for example, the wireless card or the wireless card in your laptop. It could also be software on the laptop. Because what Windows tries to do when you connect to any network is it tries to figure out, is this a public network? Is this a home network? It wants to know what it is to help secure the laptop so no one can try to get it, any of your data. So it could also be security software on your computer that's doing it. I would try it somewhere else just to see if the behavior is different or the same. If it is the same, I would make sure Windows is fully updated. So once again, talk about those updates again. And I'd also take a look at the different software that's on your computer. which there could be extra security software on your computer that's causing a pause or a delay that's not allowing you to use the internet right away without rebooting. Outside of that, I would potentially look at even if it is, a lot of times you get laptops that just have a lot of software on them, but it's also difficult to know which software you can safely remove and which ones you can't. I might actually recommend either calling Dell to give them the issue, because if it is something they have with similar devices, they might have an easy fix for you, or even look up, in this case, for any kind of, they have computer checkups, which might also be able to assist in a variety of locations. But I would say test it at a different spot. Contact Dell, because they might have a solution for you in an update. Worst case, you could take it in to see if there's computer software that they could clean up or remove from your computer while still making sure that you can use the laptop.
Yeah, makes sense. Thank you, Betsy. Let's go to Gene in Mount Horeb. Hi, Gene.
Hi. I have a question and a problem. My question is about the iOS 11.3.0. I read the Forbes article about updating to that and having it eat your batteries alive on your cell phone. And I'm wondering if that's just an individual issue or if that's a system-wide, you know, everybody's having that problem. And then my question is, for the past 4 or 5 days, both of my iPads, one's a Pro, one's a Mini, have been spontaneously locking up. So I have to, you know, put in the passcode and start over with whatever I'm doing.
Okay. What do you got for us on this one, Jesse?
So this is a difficult one. It's possible that the update does have some issues that cause this. They might be unexpected or expected. There are a couple options. One, you could... Okay, I have a few. One could be rebooting your device often, which might at least help it to be more usable in the short term. Another option is actually to restore your iPads to a previous version of iOS, and there are instructions how to do that on the internet through iTunes. Another option is to wait for the next update. It's possible that if there is an issue with the current update, a newer update is going to resolve the issue. I think in my case, if I were to pick one of those, it would probably be to attempt a restore from a previous version. Although you'd want it to be on a computer that you've actually manually synchronized on, so you have all the most updated content and applications. Because anytime I ever hear restore, I'm always concerned with losing data.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And here we are, Jesse. We are about out of time. Well, it's been a fun time. I wasn't sure we'd get a lot of questions about smart speakers, but we did indeed. And I want to thank you all for listening in. Today, our guest has been Jesse LeGrew. He is technical team lead within the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Division of Information Technology, focuses on desktop and laptop security issues. Always fun to have him with us. He deals a lot, especially with security, and so it's fun to have him with us today. And he'll be back on July 2nd, we'll do this all over again. Jesse, thanks again for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll hear about the latest entry in a series of mysteries set in Door County. Patricia Skalka will be joining us for that. And then at 11:45, we'll hear about the latest microbiome research taking place at the UW-Madison. In the meantime, hey, thanks a lot for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us.